This is an ABC podcast.
Today it's the story of how Lavinia Codd disappeared from her own head and how she had to reintroduce her old self back into her life bit by bit. In 2001, Lavinia was going to a ball. It was a work event. She was there with her husband. And that night she felt a peculiar sizzling sensation in her brain. When she saw her doctors, they thought it was a severe migraine, but it was far more serious than that. Lavinia felt her old self had died, and she'd somehow become a different person. As she slowly recovered, she tried to get back the life that she'd had before. She was advised to rest up, to take it easy. But instead, Lavinia threw herself into finding out so much more about how the brain works and how it regenerates. And today, Lavinia Codd is a researcher at the Queensland Brain Institute. Hi, Lavinia.
Hi.
Let's talk about this night in question. How old were you on this night in 2001?
I was 31, just before my 32nd birthday, so yep, 31.
And what was your life like? You had a family? Did you have kids by then?
Two kids. I had one aged 2 3/4 and one 11 months old, so yeah.
And what was your life like? What kind of work life did you have?
So at that stage, I had previously been an accountant, but when I stopped work to have the kids, I'd gone back to do a science degree because I'd always been interested. So I was partway through the first year of a science degree.
So you were having your first night out in ages because you had young kids.
Yep, ages.
Your husband.
Looking fabulous.
You were? What were you wearing, if you don't mind me asking?
Long red ball dress, and my husband was in his tux, and we were out on the town having a great time.
All right. So it was that glam, was it? Really all frocked up for a big night out.
Yep, all frocked up.
Okay. And what was the event?
It was my husband's workplace annual ball.
So who dropped you off that night?
My dad, yeah. My dad, I remember that part really clearly, which is odd for some reason. I think Mum and Dad were happy to be looking after the kids for us and to see us going out and having a good time. And it was just, I felt very daughter-like as my father dropped us off at the door. So, yeah.
Well, like prom night or something.
Yeah, something a bit like that, yeah.
What did the room look like when you first walked in? Do you remember?
Big function room. No, there's not much I remember about that. Just done up for a ball, yeah.
And aside from feeling good about going out and being all dressed up and all that and having a bit of a night out, how were you feeling physically that night?
I actually had a little bit of a headache for the 2 days beforehand, but it was just a headache. It wasn't a migraine. I did sometimes get migraines, but this was just a headache because, I was going to the ball. So, I'd taken some Panadol, but I was fine apart from that.
At what point did you notice that something wasn't quite right?
We sat down. I was still breastfeeding, so I was drinking Coke. And I'd taken my first sip of Coke, and I sort of, I was still feeling okay. And then there was an announcement that was made. Somebody made a big grand announcement. And so there were some flashing lights as part of that announcement. So sort of like little mini indoor fireworks, just about 6 or 8 bright sparks. And that's when I heard the little sizzle sound that you mentioned. So
you heard it, did you?
Yeah, it was just, it sounded like a match being put out underwater. That's my very distinct recollection. That little sound. So, when you have a lit match and you hold it underwater and that sound. So that happened. But I didn't, I think, actually, were we standing at this stage? I don't remember. But I didn't, put it this way, I didn't faint. I didn't fall over. I didn't feel particularly weak. I just felt really off. But it wasn't until I started reading the menu, I was trying to read the menu and I couldn't. Everything just looked strange. And I was
What do you mean you couldn't? It wasn't legible or?
No, I could read. I was only reading the right-hand side, so the sentences weren't making sense, So I was only reading the right-hand side of the menu, of the line, of each line. And I'm going to my husband, what are they serving us? I don't understand. And I obviously wasn't making much sense. I was obviously a bit confused. And, my husband, being practical, held up his fingers and said, how many fingers am I holding up? Because he thought there was something wrong with my vision. But that's when, I looked at his hand and I'm thinking, okay, I've got to count these fingers. But I could only do it if I touched each finger in turn. I had to pull the finger down, basically ticking each finger off. And he was only holding up 3 fingers. So I really should have been able to just look at them and say that you've got 3 fingers.
And were you thinking like, oh, this is ridiculous, I should be able to do this?
No, I was
alarmed?
probably more bemused at this stage. I was in a lot of pain, so that was probably dominating what I was thinking. Scott was the one who was proactive in the, well, this is really strange. Like, this is just not right. This is more than a migraine.
Were you speaking clearly or were you
facing? Yes, no, right. I had none of the typical symptoms of stroke. So, you know, we're told the FAST acronym, face, arm, speech, time. So facial droop, arm paralysis, problems with speech, and then it's time to go to the hospital. That didn't cover me at all. I had none of those deficits because my stroke was in a different part of the brain. But, you know, my husband obviously knew something was wrong, apart from the fact that I was in incredible pain. And we actually went straight to the hospital. So we were probably at hospital, you know, within half an hour of the stroke. So probably right in time to be having the clot-lysing drugs. But
yeah, what happened once you got to the hospital?
Well, you know, like I said, I didn't display any of the typical symptoms. I was walking and talking. I probably didn't sound confused, although I think, well, no, I think I did sound confused. But regardless, I was misdiagnosed, you know, as a migraine and given the migraine drugs and sent home, you know, as you would. You don't keep people in hospital for a migraine, so.
So what could you do once you got home?
Well, I slept. No, I couldn't do anything, really. I couldn't you know, undress or anything. My husband had to deal with all that for me. It was all, yeah, I was just too confused to deal with any of that.
You're in so much pain you couldn't undress and
yeah, change. Well, it was more than the pain. I just didn't know what I was doing. You know, what's a zip? Where's a zip? How do I?
What's a zip?
Yeah, well, right.
That's like, not a migraine, is it? That's definitely not a migraine. I mean, I don't know. Maybe not. I've never had a migraine, so I don't know. But
maybe some people are like that. I don't know. It was pretty confused. And I really should have asked my husband before I came, but I can't remember. It was either the day after. I think it was the next day or the day after that, but I think it was the next day that he took me back to the hospital because...
Had you been sleeping in that time?
I had been sleeping, but it wasn't great sleep. And, you know, my vision was still dodgy. Actually, you know, at this stage, we didn't really know how bad the vision was because nobody had stood in front of me and said, you know, can you see my wiggling fingers? That wasn't until, you know, ages later in the hospital when my neurologist said, can you see my fingers wiggling? And I'm going, of course I can see them, but I'm only pointing to his left hand, which is on my right side. And he's going, what about this side? And I'm going, what side? And that, and then, you know, that was a few days later when I realised that I actually had no vision on the left at all at that stage.
So you didn't...
I wasn't conscious of it. You know, we knew I was having trouble reading, but I wasn't conscious of just how bad it was.
So you were, what, blinded in your left eye?
No, it's not the eye, it's the brain. So it's left field of both eyes. So everything on the left. So if I look at you, I mean, I've regained my central vision's fine and my right field of vision is fine. But the left field, so, you know, I've got the middle 30 degrees and then from then on the left, I it's just not there. And
so it's not the eye. It's the
brain.
It's the seeing
through
the
eye. Yes, it's the seeing, yeah. Yeah.
And the processing of that.
In terms of straight sensation, it's the left field. But you know, I have other. It wasn't just that part of the brain that was damaged. You know, there are other deficits that went along with it.
So you don't notice then.
Until it was
not
pointed
fully
out.
Understand
to me.
It.
No.
Right.
Yeah. I wasn't conscious of it. I knew something was wrong, but I couldn't. It wasn't until it was, you know, really pointed out to me that then I could recognise that's what was wrong.
So once you went back to hospital.
Okay, so, yeah, well, that's...
And what was the interval there? What was the interval there between the first and second visit?
So I can't remember. I either went the day after the stroke, you know, the day after or the 2 days after. I can't really, you know, my memory's a bit hazy and I should check these things. But so we went back and that's because I was still very confused and still had problems. That's when they did the CT. And
what did the CT reveal?
A bloody big hole in my head. You know, that I'd had a stroke. It wasn't from a bleed. There was, you know.
I'm sure the doctors didn't put it to you quite that way.
Sorry, I've probably
got a
sworn
big
on.
Hole in your head. Yeah, that's all.
No.
But what, so you had, when you say, what do you mean by that? Sorry, a hole in your head.
Well, they could see the stroke. They could see the lesion. It was evident on their scans that I had had a stroke.
So it wasn't just like bleeding. It was...
No, because I didn't, you know, there's two forms of stroke, two main forms of stroke, hemorrhagic and ischemic. A hemorrhagic stroke is when there's a bleed, and an ischemic stroke is when there's a clot or a blockage in an artery. And I had the more common form, which is ischemic, which is where there was a block. But by the time, you know, they'd done the scan, that blockage had probably cleared and, you know, but the death had already happened. The cells had already died. Although they actually continue to die for quite some time afterwards. But by then it's too late.
I mean, a misdiagnosis is a misdiagnosis. But what did that interval cost you, do you think? The fact that it hadn't been picked up on that first trip to hospital.
Okay. If they'd either mechanically or surgically removed the clot or given me clot-lysing drugs, the TPA, tissue plasminogen activator, potentially the clot would have cleared and I would have had very little damage. So potentially.
So what was happening all that time?
Well, cells were dying. That's cells the thing. Were dying. So you have a central area where the clot is, and so there's an area of necrosis. So the cells die, and there's nothing you can do about that. The cells are going to die. But then surrounding that core area of infarct, there's what they call the ischemic penumbra, which is where there's limited blood flow. So there is still some blood getting through, so the cells are still getting oxygen and nutrients, but to a lesser degree. But if you can restore the blood flow, then potentially those cells will survive. But instead, my stroke just got bigger and bigger because, you know, you can only give TPA within the first couple of hours of stroke. It's only safe to give it within the first 3 hours, potentially a couple of more hours after that. But, you know, it carries with it a risk of bleeding. You know, you can convert from an ischemic stroke to a hemorrhagic stroke. So it's not totally clear cut, but you know, who knows? Maybe they wouldn't have treated me. I don't know. Hindsight's a wonderful thing.
So the damage was done by then, in other words.
Yeah, damage.
And what happened once they broke the news to you?
Well, that was a pretty intense moment. So I'm still in a lot of pain at this stage, and my husband's there, and the doctor's come in, a different doctor actually, very nice man. And he said, you know, I'm really sorry, I've got to tell you this, but and I can't believe I'm telling you this given your age, but you've actually had a stroke. And I knew what a stroke was, so I knew that meant part of my brain was dead.
This is before you're the scientist that
you
are now.
Yeah, before I was
You're not
scientist.
Talking about ischemic versus hemorrhagic strokes versus bloody
Forget
blah,
all that
blah, blah, blah.
I just knew part of my brain was dead. Right. You know, I knew what a stroke was in principle. And so they told me, and then he left the room for a while, and of course I, you know, did what you would expect.
Fell to pieces a bit.
And my husband was there holding my hand, and the poor nurse came in to take some blood, and I'm saying, I'm sorry, I'm crying, and she's going, it's all right, you know, I would be too, it's a bit of a shock, you know, so it's just a pretty unpleasant experience, to be honest.
I am with Lavinia Codd. She's a stroke survivor who is now a researcher into neurogenesis, which means the way the brain makes new cells, new brain cells. She's a postdoctoral research fellow at the Queensland Brain Institute at the University of Queensland. How do you make sense of that kind of information? Like, you were 31.
Yeah,
And you're not a candidate normally. You're not the classic candidate for stroke, are you?
No, I'm not a typical. I mean, most stroke.
You're not a smoker or anything like that?
No, I didn't have any of the prerequisites. I didn't have any of the clotting factors in my blood that might potentially make you more likely to clot. I wasn't on the pill. My son was 11 months old, so I was out of that sort of postpartum danger period. I didn't smoke. I wasn't overweight. I didn't drink heavily. I didn't have high blood pressure, no atrial fibrillation, you know, none of the things that would go hand in hand with stroke.
Did the thought occur to you this is somehow horribly unfair at the time, that someone like you should have this, or was that was a thought that had to wait another day or something?
No, I'll always be angry about the stroke. I'll never fully accept it, but there's no point in saying, why me? I mean, it's happened. Things happen. I was probably more concerned about what did it mean for my future? Well, the fear of having another stroke, because they couldn't actually tell me why I'd had the first stroke. So the only thing standing between me and another stroke was aspirin, you know.
So why did it? Do you have any idea now?
No.
No idea why that's right.
Well, migraine, a stroke. I've got a very convoluted theory about, or hypothesis, I should say, about why I had it, to do with the flashing lights and my blood vessels being compromised because of the headache that I had at the time. But
really?
I have no evidence for that whatsoever.
Right. So don't go to discos, kids.
Yeah, I don't. But, you know, if you're a normal person, it's probably fine. But, you know, I'm just going to assume that a whole lot of things had to happen at this one point in time, and it was just very unlucky. So if those things don't happen again at the one point in time, I'm not going to have another stroke. That's what I cling to.
So what could they do for you in the short term then, given that the damage had been done?
Well, nothing. I mean, you know, I was in hospital for 5 days or a week. I can't, I can't remember. My memory's really hazy of that time.
So they gave you blood thinning tablets or something like that?
Yes, yeah. I think I was on aspirin in hospital, and then I was on aspirin until a month later. Then I went on to warfarin for a year, which is another sort of stronger blood thinner, and I was on that for a year or two. And then we decided my risk, well, because we didn't really know what it was, and warfarin's not the most pleasant drug to be on, I went back to aspirin. So that was an interesting decision to make.
Once you were back at home, what was different?
Everything. obviously by this stage I knew that my vision was impaired, which meant I couldn't drive, and I couldn't drive for a year. I've mentioned the vision. So I've had several parts of my brain that have been damaged. So the occipital lobe, the medial occipital lobe, which was damaged for me, covers vision. So that's just sight. But the medial temporal lobe and the hippocampus, which is a very deep brain structure, probably had a bigger effect on my life. So the hippocampus is part of the brain which is really critical in learning and memory.
Are you saying there were two parts of the brain that were affected?
Well, three. So the hippocampus, the temporal lobe, and the occipital lobe. So it was,
so you had an injury in three different places?
But they're all right next to each other. Oh, okay. They're all supplied by the one artery, right. Or linked arteries. So it wasn't multiple strokes. It was just the one stroke. But your brain is really structured in what it does. So different parts have different functions. So, sight. The hippocampus, you need functioning hippocampi to be able to form new memories. So if you take out both hippocampi, which is what happened with one of the most famous neurological patients known to man, HM, Henry Mollison, he had both hippocampi removed. From that point on, because he had intractable epilepsy, they were trying to save his life. From that point on, he could never form a new declarative memory. So he could never read a book and remember it the next day. He could learn procedural memories, like he could learn to ride a bike or a task, something mechanical, but he couldn't form new memories. So I've lost...
Oh, yeah, I heard about this
guy. Yeah, super famous, yeah.
And I can't remember whether he was any happier or less happy for not being able to do that.
Well, he was a teenager when it happened, right. So, I mean, it would have gotten to a stage where he didn't recognise himself in the mirror, probably. I mean, I think he could
not
remember
so
his old memories, though. That's the thing. His old memories and my old memories are totally intact. Yeah,
all there.
He could remember his old house. You know, I could remember my old house. I just couldn't... Because of the medial temporal lobe damage, I couldn't, I could remember my house, but I couldn't place myself within it. It's really hard.
You mean
concept.
Navigationally, you mean?
Yeah, yeah.
The layout of
layout of the house. Right. I kept getting lost in my own home. So luckily we at that stage living in a long thin house. Now I've got to point out, this is the house I grew up in. So my parents had moved out, and when we came back from overseas, we'd moved in. So this is a house I had spent, you know, three quarters of my life living in. I obviously knew it very well, but all of a sudden I would get lost in my own home. I couldn't recognise my kitchen. I could recognise the fact that it was a kitchen because I knew what a tap was and what a hot plate was, but I couldn't recognise it as my kitchen. It didn't feel familiar. And then getting out the front door was... Well, first of all, I couldn't drive, but then even just making sure I was going to manage to get back to my own home was, because this was before sat-nav, you know, it was before, you know, phones that had maps on them. So it was all pretty daunting. I remember the first time I ventured into town, I knew from my old memories that if I caught the bus from the top of the hill, it would take me straight into town, and that's where the bank was, and I just had to cross the road. What happened, though, is I crossed the road, got into the bank, and then got lost in the bank. I actually couldn't find my way out of the bank. And they must have, I don't know what they thought of me. They were very nice, but I was, you know, when I'd finished my banking and they'd had to help me with that, I was making a deposit and they had to step me through it. When I went to leave, I could see through the window, I could see the pavement, I could see people walking, and I knew that's where I wanted to go, but I couldn't recognise the door because it looked like the window. And it wasn't until, so I actually even went behind a sign to look out the window thinking, oh, God, you know, this is embarrassing. I don't know how to get out there and I don't want to ask. And then I heard the doors open. I heard the whooshing sound and I knew that meant the doors were opening.
Door.
Yes. So I quickly turned around and could see people moving then through the door. So I followed the sound and the people and managed to make my way out. So
your brain knows there is such a thing as a door for a start.
Yep.
Okay. And you came in through that door. you're not certain what it looks like.
No.
But you know what it sounds like.
Yeah, and I didn't know where it was with respect to me. You know, space was, I didn't know the relationship between my position and the door's position.
Could you hear where it was, though?
Yes. And when I heard it, then I could locate it. Yeah.
Well, what you're describing sounds to me like a very long period of your life spent with low to high level anxiety. Oh. I mean, if you don't know where you are, in the most simple thing, and also worrying that people assume you're drunk or on drugs.
Oh, yeah. And worrying that you won't recognise people, which happened all the time. The first couple of years I had a lot of trouble with faces. I don't really now, although I'm not great with faces, but a lot of people aren't great with faces. But for the first, you know, say 5 years, I was dreadful with faces. So, and I would forget conversations with people. So, you know, I'd meet them in the shop and I'd finally realise from the conversation who they were. But then I could run into them 2 weeks later and not remember the conversation. But the thing
you're describing my life right now, there, dreadful. Lavinia. That's my life. I mean, I'm supposedly fine, so I don't know. But nonetheless, I suppose every deficit you feel very painful.
Oh, yeah. And you just feel stupid all the time. I mean, I was used to being relatively intelligent. And so all of a sudden, I felt really dumb. And that happened overnight. I'm not saying I was dumb. That's how I felt. I felt incompetent to be dealing with people. I just felt stupid, and that's such an unpleasant feeling because I was used to being looked at as an intelligent person, and all of a sudden I just felt stupid.
This sad person who needs to be shown what a door is and where it is.
And you know, doing the shopping was hard. Everything was hard, you know. And, you know, so much easier than if I'd had paralysis or speech problems, let me just say that. You know, if you're going to have a stroke, I think having aphasia, any of the aphasias where you have problems communicating, would be so much worse. And I didn't have to deal with paralysis, so I didn't, you know, I could still walk and talk fine. So in that respect, I got off really lightly.
Yeah, but in the other hand, it's like, well, what's wrong with you, you know? What about your kids? Could you recognise them?
So I could, but I had this, because I had so much trouble with other people, I developed this great fear of not recognising them. So as I said, I couldn't drive for the first year. And then when I went back and had all the tests and they said, no, you've got enough vision and your driving is fine, we'll let you have your licence back. And I have a medical certificate for that. You know, that's something that gets renewed annually. So this was a year after the stroke, because I was back driving, because my husband had been dropping my daughter at kindy, and now I took that function over. But I was so concerned that I wouldn't recognise my daughter when I went to pick her up, that I used to memorise what she wore, you know, but verbally I used to remember, you know, red shorts and blue T-shirt or whatever it was she was wearing. And
So you memorised that?
Verbally.
Yeah. So you didn't get it. You didn't try and hold a picture of that.
No, I couldn't. No, I had to use verbal cues for everything, or other ways of remembering things,
like a mnemonic. You mean you'd have to go, red shorts, blue top, that sort of thing.
Yeah,
to say that again and
rhyme,
again.
Rhyme, you know, turn it into a rhyme or whatever. My verbal memory is great. I can remember lists of things, lots and lots of lists of things, and that's, you know, how I get by. But only if I concentrate, if I try, my memory is very poor if I'm not really attending to something, but if I really pay attention and I really choose and I go make a lot of effort to remember something, I've got a great memory, just not in other respects. So a year after the stroke and I'm trying to pick my daughter up, and I was so scared that I wouldn't recognize her that I had to do this verbal memorizing technique. Now, I didn't ever not recognize her, but I was just so
worried. You didn't
bring
the wrong kid home, did you?
Or what would the other parents think?
You can get in trouble for that.
Yeah, you can. Well, what would my daughter think if I didn't recognise her? You know.
I'm laughing, but it actually must have been very horrible, anxious thought because, bad mother, you know, again, doesn't even know what her own daughter looks
and
like.
And what should she actually be in charge of these small children, you know?
What were you beginning to think about the old you pre-stroke and the person you'd become?
There was definitely a discontinuity. So there was a definitely before stroke Lavinia and an after stroke Lavinia. And in my mind at that time, and for a good couple of years after the stroke, they were two completely distinct people. I felt no connection with the old Lavinia. I totally felt like I was a brand new person. I had a new personality. I had new abilities or disabilities. You know, I had a new role in life. Everything was different.
A brand new person, not like a twist on the old self.
No, I was a completely different person. I really thought I'd died and there was a new me. Now, I mean, that didn't last forever. I now feel continuous with my pre-stroke Lavinia. But I think because reality was so hard for me to grasp, you know, because when I opened my eyes, what I was seeing, you know, I might be able to recognise the kitchen, like I said, but it wasn't my kitchen. And then you start questioning reality. You know, there was a lot of questioning, is this really me? And so it was easier just to have two Lavinias, the before-stroke Lavinia and the after-stroke Lavinia.
This might seem like a really odd question, but I've had conversations with people who've had brain injuries on the show before, whether mm-hmm. they've fallen off something or a stroke or something like that. And there's a period they go through, which is really odd, where they begin to think that everyone's conspiring or they're living in some weird alternate reality or something like that. Did you have that?
Yes, yeah. You start thinking, have I actually died? Is this a new dimension or, you know,
purgatory
whatever.
Or something, yes.
Yeah, yeah. But then I had my husband continually saying, no, it's still the same you know, you're fine, you'll be fine, lovey.
Yes, but then he would say that.
Yeah, I know. If you're really paranoid, yes. No.
So that must have been quite disconcerting then, not feeling who you are, who you are, and you're like in the skin of someone else or something.
Yes, and I was used to being really confident, and so all of a sudden I'm this meek person who doesn't really know what's going on and can't trust what her eyes are telling her, and yeah, it's just a horrible, horrible feeling.
On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
So you'd gone home after this injury, you're trying to recover. What kind of advice did you get in order to recover?
Well, the initial advice from actually quite a few of the doctors was just go home and relax and watch daytime television, because let's face it, there wasn't actually any therapies they could come up with on the spot to give me. I didn't need a physiotherapist because I didn't have paralysis. I didn't need a speech therapist because I didn't have any of the aphasias. Even an OT wasn't probably going to help me. You know, there was really nothing they could give me to get better.
Yeah, daytime TV is going to make you go backwards rather than forwards, I think.
It'll just make you go insane. Yeah. There's only so much you can watch. It's really bad.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, infomercials and everything like that.
Yep.
Yeah, that's not going to be good for you.
No.
Now, we're talking about the years 2001, 2002, and brain science has changed completely since then, hasn't it?
So, totally.
So you wouldn't be likely to get the same advice today.
I mean, one therapy that I could have was seeing a neuropsychologist, and luckily my neurologist did say you should go and see a neuropsychologist and have your
IQ. What is a neuropsychologist?
Well, it's a psychologist who has a bit more neuroscience to them, so they understand a bit more about when you have a disease or a stroke or whatever, what impact that's going to have on your functioning. So I went and saw Andrew McAllister at the RBWH, and that was the best thing I possibly could have done. That was a game changer for me. So Andy was fantastic. You know, he not only treated my anxiety and anger, because I did have an anger management issue at the time. I was a fairly angry person. He helped me deal with that. But he also, you know, when I was saying, I need to get better, what am I going to do? And he used to give me little bits of homework because he knew that that's what I wanted. And in the end he said, well, you know, you should go back to uni. And I'm going, well, I can't. I'm just not smart enough anymore. And he said, well, let's test that. And, you know.
So he said, go back to uni.
Yeah, yeah. But he said, well,
were you surprised when he said that?
Well, I was, and I refused initially. I said, there's no way I could possibly go back to uni. And, you know, so he did the IQ test, and there were obviously areas where I had big deficits. You know, there were obvious areas that stood out from the rest. But on the whole, you know, I was smart enough to go back to uni. And it was only with his sort of, well, he got fairly vehement in the end and, you know, said stop being an idiot and being a whinger.
It sounds like on that IQ test you'd be able to describe at length what the hippocampus is, where it's located, what it does,
well,
the hormones that affect
time.
It. But where is the door? Not so good.
Yeah.
Is that what it was like?
Yeah. Well, at the time, though, no, I didn't have any neuroscience background.
Okay.
At the time it was straight science. I was still doing first year subjects, so no.
Just you mentioned there he helped you with your anger management. How did he do that? What did he tell you needed to do in order to get past
this
that?
This is actually embarrassing. It was such an easy fix, and I can't believe it was as easy as it was. In the end, I had to keep a diary every time I lost my temper. I had to keep a diary of the triggers, and that turned into a little bit of a game with my husband, because every time I'd go to, he could see me losing it. And he'd go, quick, quick, where's the diary? Quick, got to write it down. And it was just that, it was like counting to 10. You know, it was just that little break, that little circuit breaker that actually stopped me losing my temper. I was still angry. I'll always be angry about the stroke. That will never fade. But the quick to anger response was very easy to fix, and it was just having that little circuit breaker.
Do you still go to the diary? I'm so interested in this idea.
No, I did.
You have a virtual diary in your head
Yeah, I threw it out eventually because when I went back to it a few years later, I was so embarrassed about the things that I'd written, about the things that would upset me. It's like, seriously? You're really that bad? But I was, so yeah. So no, so he helped me with that, and basically, I wasn't clinically depressed. I was never on antidepressants, although I was offered them. I was actually too scared of them at the time. I wouldn't be now, but I was at the time because I didn't know how they worked. But he just gave me a lot of counselling, you know, let me vent and whinge, because it's much easier to whinge to a stranger than it is to your own family, because, you know, you're not hurting them.
You're not hurting them.
No.
Once you got to the 1 year mark, 1 year after the stroke, what did you do then?
Oh, I panicked because, you know, initially you're told as a stroke survivor, okay, well, you've got a period of recovery and that'll basically be a year or two. And then you'll plateau, you know, and from then on your recovery, if it happens, will be minuscule. And that's based on a lot of research. You know, there's a lot of data out there saying that's how it is, that there is this plateau. But that's lumping all strokes together. It's not for the individual. And I think it's also a lot of that relates to motor function deficits, not cognitive deficits like I'm experiencing. So basically I got to a year and all of a sudden I'm thinking, oh, I'm not better enough. I'm nowhere near recovered enough.
This is as good as it gets.
Yeah, this just can't be it. I was so upset that first year. You know, I was beside myself. I couldn't comprehend that this was as good as I was going to recover. And then I kept getting better. And so then I got to the second year and I went through the same panic because I thought, oh, did they say, you know, was it 1 or 2 years? I can't remember. So maybe the plateau will start now. And then, okay, so I will be honest, your recovery, even in terms of cognition, does slow down, but it keeps on happening for me. You know, I can only talk about personal experience. For the great masses who have strokes, maybe their experiences are different if you look at it as a population. But if you look at it as an individual, I'm still conscious that I'm getting better. And it's been, you know, 16 and a half years now. And, you know, my daughter just a couple of months ago said, you know, she could notice differences compared to a year ago. You know, I was trying to navigate somewhere and just in my attitude of if I was getting lost, I was better able to deal with it. That's still an improvement, you know, and she was conscious of it and conscious of it enough to raise it without me asking her. So if the people around me can notice improvements after that long, then, you know, as far as I'm concerned, recovery just happens forever.
You said your neuropsychologist really encouraged you to go back to uni and you went, that's just not possible. Was it the IQ test that persuaded you you might be able to do it? Or what changed you? What turned you around?
Well, probably Andy's attitude. He was wonderful. He just basically told me to stop being a whinger and get on with it. I was better off than a lot of people and what was I complaining about? Yeah, the IQ, I needed the...
So psychologists do sometimes say, suck it up, snowflake.
Yeah, suck it up, buttercup. That was pretty much it. Right. But it was exactly the right attitude that I needed. He was very, very good at pegging what I needed to hear. I needed the crutch of an IQ test to say, yes, my IQ is fine, although there's deficits. My overall IQ was fine. I needed that reassurance and he gave it to me. And then he gave me the kick in the backside to stop being pathetic. My husband fully supported me. He wanted me to go back to uni. Everyone around me wanted to go back to uni. Actually, I've got to say, I did try and go back that first semester, which was before I'd seen the neuropsychologist. That was actually only a couple of weeks after the stroke, and that was a bit of a joke. That was impossible because my sister came with me to the lecture, and we went and saw the lecturer, Professor Melissa Brown, and she was wonderful. She was willing to have me do the exams in her room and everything. She was going to bend over backwards to help me, but it just wasn't possible. You know, I couldn't function at all. So that was my one attempt at going back to uni. And then the next year I attempted, you know, after Andy had told me, you know, come on, you know.
But you'd recovered somewhat at that point.
Yeah, I'd recovered a lot. By this stage, you know, I could get round a lot easily, more easily. My confidence was better. I still got lost, don't get me wrong. I mean, I still get lost now. But there was a lot more confidence and a lot more drive to get back to the life that I had before. I mean, I had a fantastic life. I was really, really, really happy before the stroke. I had a wonderful family, wonderful husband, two perfect kids. You know, I was studying stuff that I was really enjoying. I loved going back to UQ. I had fantastic lecturers and, you know, I was just really enjoying being in this learning environment and learning the stuff that, you know, that I'd remembered from high school to such a much more in-depth level. And I just loved learning how things worked. So I was in the world's best place. I was so happy. And I wanted that back.
Before the stroke, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was like a country you wanted to go back to or something.
Yes, yeah. I really, really wanted that back. And the only way to get it back was actually just to start living my life how I wanted to.
But what was the reality of that, Lavinia, once you were actually at uni and you still had some of these cognitive deficits from the stroke?
Yeah, well, I had to change my learning strategy. So I guess I was lucky because I had the commerce degree before the science degree. So when I did commerce back in the 80s, the late 80s, I learnt very verbally. I was very good at mnemonics and, you know, as we discussed before, learning, you know, using rhymes and verbal techniques to memorise. I had quite a good verbal memory that way and quite a good technique based on that commerce degree. But when I started doing science, it's obviously there's still a lot of verbal learning, but there's also a lot of visual learning, so graphs and concept maps.
The periodic table.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. All of that. It's all very visual. And I could no longer just look at a graph and know what it meant. I had, you know, I had to have a different approach to learning a graph. I had to step through each axis and look at the curve and really think about what the curve meant and the slope of the curve and the intersection. You know, I had to, it was a very, very much mechanical process as opposed to it having been intuitive before. But luckily for me, I had the, you know, the verbal memory techniques that I developed as an accountant to use then. So I could fall back on that method of learning.
Isn't this what, and I'm going to probably misquote or misunderstand it here, I don't know, that Daniel Kanahan talks about slow learning and fast learning, or slow thinking and fast thinking.
And deep processing. And
yeah. You know, normally when you look at a graph, you see a curve and you know what that means almost instantly.
Yeah.
What, you know,
so
something's
I
going up exponentially.
Yep.
But you have to turn that into slow thinking.
Yes.
You have to go, this is a graph.
Very much.
Right.
Yeah.
And you have to really look at it.
I have to look at what the axes, what the units are. I have to really think, okay, that's a day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days. And so I'm going up in time. And what is the y-axis doing in time?
So no shortcuts, in other words.
No.
So you have to work twice as hard then?
For that sort of thing, yes. And then anatomy almost killed me. That was my worst subject because that was all, you know, you had the practical classes, you had to recognize bones and which way
the
they were
connected
orientated.
To the leg bone, the leg base connected to the thigh bone.
The
that's
clavicle,
how you remember it.
You know, which way is it orientated? I couldn't do 3D mental rotations. So I couldn't, you weren't allowed to touch it in the exam. You had to be able to rotate it in your head to say whether it was left or right. And I physically could not do that. So I had to guess with that one.
Still, what were your results like?
I know. Well, that one was pretty bad. I got a 4 for that. So,
4 out of 7.
So 4's just a pass.
But what were your results by and large like, though?
Okay, so when I first went back, I did a lot of psychology subjects because my neuropsychologist was amazing and very helpful. And for a while there, I thought I might do psychology, become a neuropsychologist. So I was doing fairly well in those. I was used to getting straight 7s. And then after the stroke, I still got 7s because I was doing one subject at a time. I did one subject a semester for a while, which is a very low load. You know, part-time is usually 2 or 3 subjects. I was doing one subject. Mind you, I did have 2 small kids and a stroke. But so, no, I didn't. But I was, to be fair, I was only doing one subject at a time. And then chemistry came along and that subject almost also killed me. But actually, that was an interesting subject because that's when I had a really big leap forward in terms of my ability to navigate. And I wonder if it's this principle of generalization. So, you know, one of the things I remember I spent, because I couldn't do these 3D rotations, One of the chiral enantiomers, you'll have a central carbon atom, and it's the way the molecule is structured. It can either have a right configuration or a left configuration.
So you need to have a kind of a 3D model of that in your head?
Yes, and I couldn't do that. So I spent, weeks and weeks and weeks, so much time imagining my wrist as the central carbon atom and then my fingers were the surrounding atoms, and was that going left or right? And also we were doing electrical circuits, so I kept drawing these electrical circuits over and over. I was reading these big tables for chemistry. It was a really visually intensive, or visual learning, trying to imagine things visually intensive course, and it almost killed me. I didn't do so well in that subject, but I did at that time actually start having less trouble getting lost. I started being able to find my car more easily in the car park. I remember the day I managed to walk to the car park, so I navigated to the car park and find my car while sending a text message, which, I mean, that's pretty good. for someone who was having the sort of trouble I was having, I managed to do all that. And so that was when I decided, okay, I'm just going to keep getting better.
This reminds me a lot of Barbara Arrowsmith-Young's story when she came on the show. She's mentioned in Norman Doidge's book on neuroplasticity. Okay. Mm-hmm. She'd had a I'm trying to remember the nature of it now, a very severe brain injury, I think from birth. And she just really pushed to use memorization cards. And there was one, it just again and again
something
and again.
Clicks.
And
yeah.
She really put herself through hell. Mm. And then something just clicked. And once that first thing clicked, a whole lot of other things clicked into place.
Yeah.
And this is this theory, neuroplastic theory, that you create new neural pathways through that kind of awful, harrowing, tremendous effort.
And practicing one task can sometimes generalize to other tasks. Yeah.
What you're not good at.
Yes.
Practicing what you're not good at.
Yes, I really went overboard with the, with the practice questions and everything. It was a really big deal for me to just pass that subject, and I managed to get a 5. So that was, I was pretty proud of that.
So here you are today with a PhD.
Yes.
A PhD in what, neuroscience? What do we say it's in?
Neurogenesis. So neurogenesis following stroke. So I'm
pretty excited. So you're Dr. Lavinia Codd.
Yes, I am.
And you did it all. As a recovering stroke victim.
Yes, yeah. I was really fortunate. So when I went back to uni and, I was doing these subjects, and just apart from the couple of subjects I mentioned where I didn't do so well, I was getting good marks. And so I was offered a place in the Advanced Studies Program in Science that UQ has. It's this excellent program aimed at students who are doing quite well, and they were trying to keep them in fundamental science. And so as part of that, you had to find a mentor. And so this is when I really sat down and thought, what do I want to do with this science degree? Because at this stage, I was treating it like therapy. It was just helping me get better. But then I thought, well, I can actually do something with this degree, and maybe I can help myself, and maybe I can help other stroke survivors. So really what I want to do is neuroscience. So I had a look at uni and had a look at the different professors that we had there, and that's when I discovered the Queensland Brain Institute, which was literally just forming. It started in 2003 under the directorship of Professor Perry Bartlett, and I thought, well, I'll just go to the top. So I emailed Perry and met with him, and, he took me on as a student then and there, and I've really got to thank him for that, because, you could say a student's free, so it didn't cost him anything, but he invested an awful lot of, time, intellect, emotional energy in me, and a lot of side-by-side training with his one of his postdocs, Dr. Lely. She was one of my other supervisors. They invested a lot of time in me, knowing that I had had a stroke and knowing that I had a learning deficit. And he didn't turn me away. In fact, he embraced me into his own group. He didn't even send me to another group leader. He took me on himself. So I did 2 undergrad subjects with him, and then honours, and then I did a PhD with him as well.
Now, he was one of the first scientists to discover that the human brain does
produce
grow,
In 92, his lab was one of the labs, there were 2 main labs that discovered it, that there are new cells produced in the adult mammalian brain. So
in the adult brain.
And so originally, they thought it all happened embryonically, and that maybe a little bit more was happening when you were very young. But, the brain was so complex, Ramon y Cajal, the father of neuroscience, when he was first describing the brain, he just decided it was just too complex for there to be new neurons being produced, new brain cells to be produced. And there was a lot of, basically that's what the field thought. And then Perry's group, and at the same time it was one other group, actually discovered that no, new cells are being produced in the brain.
Which is terribly exciting.
Oh, yeah.
And this is the thrust of your research work.
Yeah, now. Yeah.
Can you witness such a thing under a microscope?
So this is one of my epiphany moments. This was another game changer. You know, I've had a couple of events in my life. One was meeting Andy, who told me to go back to uni. One was meeting Perry, who took me on as a student. And then there was the witnessing neurogenesis for myself. So one of the first things I did in the lab was what we call the neurosphere tissue culture assay. And that's when you take one of the neurogenic regions in the adult mammalian brain, because it is restricted in the adult. It doesn't necessarily happen everywhere, but it does happen more in particular regions. And one of those regions is the hippocampus. And that happens to be the part of the brain that's involved in learning and memory that I was damaged in myself. So if you take that part of the brain and you chop it up and digest it with enzymes so that it forms a single cell solution, so you've just got single cells floating in solution, some of those cells are stem or precursor cells. And then if you put them in an incubator with certain growth factors and you come back 2 weeks later, you can look down the microscope and see a neurosphere.
You've got a bundle.
Yeah, you've got a ball. It's basically a sphere of cells. And they know that, you know, they've done time-lapse photography. That's not just cells sort of clumping together. That's a ball of cells that have occurred because of cell division. So new cells are being produced by that central stem or precursor cell. And you end up with these balls of cells. And I remember looking down the microscope, seeing very strong evidence with my own eyes that this was actually what happens. You know, we could do this. And I'm thinking, well, if I can take this little bit out of a mouse brain and, you know, chop it up and put it in an incubator with a couple of growth factors and come back and find all these cells, many more cells than were in the dish to start with, that has to be happening in my brain. And you can't tell me it's not involved in learning, you know. And that was a real light bulb moment. It was like, wow, you know, it was so thrilling and so moving for me. The interesting thing was, though, that Lily had to describe what the neurosphere was, and I could tell with her very strong guidance that was a neurosphere. But then I spent the next year having trouble recognizing them unless somebody would point them out because it was
the
a visual thing.
Still there, right?
Yeah, and a neurosphere, you can have clumps of cells that aren't neurospheres. You know, it's the debris. So it took me a while to distinguish the two. But that moment when I first saw it, it was just a wonderful thing.
There are so many things, I think, that come out of your story, for me anyway. The first one is that back then you were given the advice to sit back and relax and watch daytime TV, and you did the opposite, and that was a much better idea.
Mm.
That seemed to have
definitely
changed your life. And the other thing was, for me, is you mentioned there that you had that awful, almost catastrophic feeling afterwards that you were a different person, something gone horribly wrong.
Mm.
And you say you don't have that feeling anymore. Is that because the new you and the old you have become integrated, or are you back to the old you? What do you think about all that?
I think a lot of my personality traits have come back. I feel more at home in my skin, and maybe, you know, maybe I'm not so obsessed with the old me and the new me. I don't dwell on it as much as I used to. You know, when I was going through that terribly confused period in my life, it's all I could think about. You know, I obsessed about dying. I obsessed about death. I wasted so much time, you know, thinking about what it was going to be like to die, which was stupid because I couldn't do anything about it. And was I the old me or was I the new me? And how could people, I was so angry, how could people not tell there was a new me? But now, you know, I'm in a really good point in my life. Everything's happy. I don't spend so much time thinking about it. But if I do think about it, then I do feel continuous now with my old me. I do feel like the loop is closed. Maybe that's just time and healing. I don't know. But I don't feel so upset by it anymore.
I mean, you're obviously quite a clever person before the stroke. Nonetheless, has that experience of being stuck in a bank, not being able to find the door, made you more patient, maybe?
I mean, I tell that story a bit. I've stopped telling it because it upsets me every time. It was such a horrible thing to go through. And I know my recovery has been so fundamental to who I am as a person that I really want that for other people. And so I really want to talk about stroke. You know, I want to talk about young stroke and raise awareness about that. But I really want to talk about the potential for recovery, and that, you know, sure, statistically speaking, stroke survivors have an accelerated cognitive decline with aging, but that doesn't have to be everyone's experience, and you should strive to be an individual and recover to the best of your ability, as opposed to just being part of the population.
That statistical picture only takes you so far, but I suppose I mean more in a personal sense, you know, if you see someone struggling in a public place.
Oh, definitely, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, yes, probably I'm more compassionate, I don't know. Maybe I was compassionate beforehand, I don't know, but yeah, I think... Yeah, it gives you a greater understanding for the trials that people go through.
Also, how about your general outlook and sort of temperament, I suppose? You've had this kind of experience where you've recovered and gone to this really interesting place against the odds or the statistical mm-hmm. picture or like. Are you an optimistic person now? Or, I don't know, or something, would you say it another way?
No, I just don't feel constrained by the limitations other people want to put on me. I think that's probably, if you want to describe that as optimism, that's how I feel. I don't feel constrained by what other people, limitations they want to impose on me. The only one who can decide what will happen to me is me, and that's up to me. My future is up to me. Nobody can decide that for me.
And the vision in the left eye?
I'd love to get that back, but that hasn't improved. That's just gone.
That's gone?
Yeah.
So you can see me waving this hand,
yeah,
but maybe not that one?
I can't see that hand
at all.
Can't
see that.
I know. I can see your shoulder moving, so I know that your hand's there, but I can't see it moving, though.
What an amazing story. And what an amazing life you have now.
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of perfect life you did get back there in the end, I suppose.
I did. I'm very happy. I love doing what I'm doing. I'm surrounded by incredible scientists doing just the most amazing work. So every day I go to work and I'm just constantly amazed at some of the things that we're discovering at QBI.
It's been such a pleasure speaking with you, Lavinia.
Thank you so much.
Lavinia Codd is a postdoctoral research fellow at the Queensland Brain Institute at the University of Queensland.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.